Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, April 3rd, day two of our spring membership campaign. This morning we check in with Governor Josh Green and get the latest on the economic uncertainty and what it means for our state. We talk about the likelihood of a special session for the state legislature and hear who the governor is naming to the state's appellate court. On The Long View, we explore the institution of marriage with Neil Milner. What are the long-term benefits, anyway? And we continue our look back at recent conversations with some of the newest additions to the state's media landscape. It's the year of our community forests, and a young upstart takes its name from the forest canopy. This is The Conversation on HPR One. I'm Catherine Cruz. And you know, this morning we woke up to the stock markets plunging following President Donald Trump's announcement of 10% tariffs on all imported goods. The move is expected to send shockwaves throughout the economy as consumers are already struggling with the rising cost of living. This comes as the Republican administration is imposing deep cuts to the federal government and firing thousands of public workers in an effort to downsize the government and reduce the deficit. On top of that, there's news today that the blue state of Maine is facing cuts to school programs funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in response to a dispute over transgender athletes that the president had with Maine Governor Janet Mills. Hawaii's Governor Josh Green witnessed that exchange last month. We spoke with him this morning about that and the possible fallout from a trade war.
The tariffs are really dangerous for our country. They are going to cause a recession, in my opinion, and that affects all of us. It affects everything we do. It probably affects travelers to Hawaii because there will be fewer people that have resources to come from not just the United States, but from other nations also. So I'm very concerned, and I'm prepared to manage the fallout from the Trump administration's decisions. But I really would prefer that they quickly pull back these tariffs and work out something with all the state governors where there's conflict, because it's just not good or healthy for anyone.
We're already grappling with the high prices of, you know, because we're an island state. And I read something early this morning that said, oh, yeah, it may mean, you know, an extra $2,000, these tariffs for the average person. So it's tough.
It's very tough. It'd be tough on a day-to-day and month-to-month basis for working people. It's also going to be tough if people were in their 60s and they've seen their savings and pensions, you know, greatly diminished, or their 401ks. You know, all of these things are very tough. And, you know, it will resolve. We'll emerge from this okay as a country and a global community, but it's too tough in the short term on some people, especially they're closer to retirement. They don't have as much wiggle room.
Well, the other headline that is a bit disconcerting is the retaliation against Maine, you know, because of its DEI policies and the concern about USDA withholding funds for the schools.
It shouldn't happen. You know, I think and hope that Maine will be able to work out some kind of understanding with the federal government. Needless to say, the feds have a lot of different levers they can pull regarding states, and that became a personal conflict, which is good to avoid in general, because none of us should let that happen if we can help it. I was there to witness the conflict, and it was, you know, it was a little distressing between the governor of Maine and the president, because I'm very fond of Governor Mills. I mean, she's a good human being. But right now, there's just a lot of conflict in the air. And for my part, I'm trying to damp it down. There are some projects that we're willing, of course, to work with the federal government on if they're going to help Hawaii. Things that were critically important, but more symbolic, like them restoring information on their websites about the heroic 442nd, ranging all the way to protecting our universities' monies. And then, of course, the macroeconomic challenges with the tariffs. So doing what I can. And I quietly, respectfully share when I'm really in opposition to their moves, just because I think they need to hear it from enough people. I don't tend to shout it out in the press too much, because I think that open conflict is probably not going to be good for anybody. But I will speak out if it's going to hurt our people.
We know that the DOD has been asked to come up with a list for a reduction in force by April 11th. And everybody's just concerned about what that might mean for Hawaii, because the DOD civilians, you know, work on everything from Red Hill issues down to the shipyard. And while the Indo-PACOM is a priority for the administration, there's a lot of unease right now.
For sure there is. Interestingly, Indo-PACOM has been spared any of the 8% cuts that were proposed nationally, because our military theater is so critical right now to everyone, particularly all across the Pacific, the questions of China and Taiwan, you know, the questions, of course, in, I think, the Gulf of Aden, and where the Houthis are causing trouble and where that's been going on. So We're not going to see those kind of cuts, but yes, if there are civilian cuts, then it could affect our resolution on Red Hill. But we're staying in constant communications. We also have to navigate the leases that the military has been asking to have executed. The deadline for that is 2029, but things have to be resolved at some point, probably sooner than that. So we are in constant communication. Cuts will slow processes down. I do directly work when asked, like the Homeland Security Director or, you know, the administration's top people, because I need to have an open channel of communications to get our money, whether it's the FEMA monies for recovering on Maui or Red Hill. You know, all these things are very relevant. So I'm going to keep doing that. That it will mean I have to go to D.C. periodically, and notwithstanding the absurd complaint from our friends over at Civil Beat that I shouldn't go to, you know, D.C., I have to. I have to be present occasionally. Promise I'll fly coach and keep it cheap, but I got to fly there and fight for us. These are the realities of the current administration, and I think it will settle down after a year. I think that Elon Musk will probably leave and go back to his company, I'm guessing, in the next couple months because of the rules. They don't necessarily follow all the rules with Elon Musk, but his company's tanking and their administration has become somewhat frustrated with him, I hear. So I don't know. I think there's just a lot of work to do, and I want people to not panic. The market will return for their, you know, retirement. Things will get better, but they may get worse a little still before they get better. And a bunch of us are going to try to fight for sane decisions.
There are so many assaults coming on so many different fronts, whether it's, you know, Medicaid and Medicare, Department of Human Services, and the reduction in employees there. Social Security, you know, I was reading that they're going to stop issuing paper checks for beneficiaries in the territories, you know, in Samoa and Guam. You know, so you just wonder how that's all going to play out in some of these remote areas where access could be a problem.
Well, we have some experience with what happens when these kind of changes get made, because when you take populations that are vulnerable or not as economically well established, they don't have all the infrastructure. They are scrambling to have internet. They're scrambling often to have bank accounts that are not, you know, having bounced checks and so on. And so you see a lot of people fall away. Some of the most vulnerable people become more vulnerable, and that's bad. So it's not good if you're trying to look out for people that are struggling. And a lot of times, some of these changes are put into place intentionally to kind of cull the roles of people on entitlement programs or social service programs. And really, that's the wrong approach. You should spend more energy and resources on prevention from people getting into trouble. Then they have to scramble and find their way back. And by then, they could be housing insecure or actually homeless. They could have drifted away from society. There's a lot of consequence from these decisions. And so states will have to, you know, make up some of the slack. I was sharing this with someone this morning that because we've had like a 20 to 30% vacancy rate in a lot of our positions statewide, when they cut certain programs, like yesterday happened with the Office of Business and Economic Development, four or five people, one was retiring, so it was four, were forced immediately out of a program because the federal government stopped funding it. But we did have a lot of open positions that they could work in, and they were able to seamlessly be taken in on other projects. So we didn't lose them. We didn't lose their income. Their families were okay. So we have a bit of a buffer, but at the same time, there's a lot of questions about what the resources will look like for states. And all of us as governors, red state and blue state governors, are worried about that. So, like I said, everyone should know that we have to buckle up for a bumpy period and a bunch of these very quick actions by the federal government. But I'm super aware of what the consequences are. We're going to save and hold back some resources this session, some appropriations, so that once we see the full scope of any cuts that would hurt people, we'll come in with those reserves in a special session and fortify programs, healthcare services, education. So I'm trying to be as strategic as possible, noting that they are, the federal government are in kind of a slash and burn mode.
You are headed over to Samoa. What's all that about?
Yeah, the 125th Flag Day is occurring right in mid-April. That's the 125th anniversary of the American flag going up in American Samoa, and I'm very humbled to accept their invitation. I haven't been able to for the last 5 years, but they've really insisted that I come over, and it's wonderful of them. So I'll come over for 2 or 3 days and celebrate the relationship we have between Samoa. We have 50,000 Samoan citizens in Hawaii, and it's good because a lot of those folks come and go from Hawaii. So a couple days over there, you know, this on top of all sorts of things. We put 3 women judges in, which was wonderful, into the circuit court, and if you don't mind, I'll make a special announcement here right now on your program that I am, as of this moment, going to nominate Karen Nakasone, so a fourth woman judge, into the chief position at the Intermediate Court of Appeals. We congratulate Judge Nakasone. She's fantastic. Right now, she's already one of the members of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and she will become, I feel strongly she'll be well embraced by the Senate. She will become the chief of that court. And it's an important thing because we're restoring some additional women leadership to government and to the courts. So there are good things out there. There really are. But some days they feel like they're dwarfed by the very large decisions that come out of Washington.
Well, Governor, we certainly appreciate your time as we navigate a very rough period, some rough waters here. But good to hear the assurance that you're taking stock, and we've got to be conservative about what we do as we wind up the legislature.
We do. We'll take care of our most vulnerable, and we will get through it. So people should not panic, but it's completely understandable if they're concerned.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Governor.
You bet.
Now, that was Governor Josh Green talking to us earlier this morning. He has not only named Karen Nakasone as head of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, but also tapped Taryn Tomasa Gifford and Karen El Homa to serve on the First Circuit Court. The fourth female judge is Kawanoe Jackson to the Third Circuit. You are back with the conversation here on day two of the spring membership campaign. And our subject today, love and marriage. Go together like a horse and carriage. Yeah, you remember that one? What's that worth to you these days? And has it changed over the decades? Joining us this morning for the Longview is HPR's Neil Milner. Good morning.
Good morning. I thought I'd do something that's reasonably stable and pleasant. It sounded marriage season is coming upon us. And it's, you know, and the world is so crazy, we know pretty much that at least at the beginning, the marriages are happy. And it turns out they tend to be healthy and stable because as the research has shown for a long time, and there was recently a piece in the National Geographic that lumped this all together and took another look, married couples tend to be healthier and happier and have higher self-esteem. And just better mental and physical conditions. We've known this for a while, and it's interesting how it keeps showing up. The quality of the marriage makes some difference, but it turns out that's not a game changer, that they're obviously in a situation like that, there's more anxiety. But generally, people who are married have much better health outcomes. They live longer, and they tend to get more and more like that as they're together longer. Whatever jokes you want to make about how long you've been married, and you and I just made some about me. That seems to be in the case. So, love and marriage going together as a horse and carriage has a certain truth to it. It turns out that maybe single men and single women might be a little healthier, and it seems to be because they work out more. But in terms of a full and pleasant life, and it's not clear from the research whether partners get the same kind of benefit. If you're together for a long time, it appears as if that's the same as being married. And so that's where it stands. So, to me, there are some other interesting questions here, one of which is why is that? There seems to be a lot of emphasis nowadays, not just on the, what do we want to call it, the psychodynamics of the relationships, which obviously are important, but also brain science. It's pretty clear that love does things to the brain the way other pleasant things do, dopamine and so right. on. And it's also, it appears as if things like relationships tend to, set off certain parts of the brain. So what you get when you're talking about this is, you know, you're talking about health benefits, but remember the world we live in, let's say the world of knowledge, the mental and the physical or the emotional and the physical really aren't separate. We know a lot more about it. We know that that's the case. when you start thinking about more of it, how much of it is related, not related to, but religions have their own views about marriage. And it seems, what's interesting to me is the language is different, but there's a lot of overlap in how mm-hmm. you talk about it. Not enough to make sure what it is. For example, when a matchmaker works or when you work, they're not going to give you a health outcome study. I mean, I come from a tradition in which there is a lot of matchmaking. I found my own wife, or she found me, depending on who's telling the story. But there is still strong matchmaking, and they're looking for certain kinds of compatibility. And if it's a religious orientation, there's a lot of cues you look for in terms of background and so on. There's another very interesting one that's essentially a website, a meet and greet website for farmers. And the justification, the explanation for it is that if you're going to live on a farm, if you're going to become a farmer's spouse, that there's certain things, certain commonalities, or at least certain things that you have to learn.
Yeah, you need to know what you're in for.
You have to know, right? Even harder working than a radio host, and so there is that kind of thing that's constantly going on. The mixing. The one that I find most interesting is how you try to overcome the loneliness and the other health outcomes, bad health outcomes, if you're not married. Now, we think a lot about that in terms of single people and so on. I've started to think about it as much because of where my status in life. Let me start this way. The population is getting older and older. You have more people living over 85. You certainly have more people who are living without a spouse. We know something about loneliness in senior living because of what happened in COVID. But also, it's interesting to think about what places do in this world, in this country, to mitigate that kind of loneliness. Mm-hmm. If your husband or your wife has just died and you're living alone for the first time in how many years, how does it work? My experience is that they overwhelm you with activities that you can choose from, and you're living in close relationships with others, which doesn't mean it's easy, but it means that you have that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of marriage, you think of companionship.
Sure.
And sense of purpose, right? You get up every morning, and if it's, because you've got a family or,
you reinforce one another. Some might call it nagging at times, but that is an important factor in the whole thing. But if you go back to think about how we dealt with elderly loneliness in the past, if you lose a spouse, sometimes we dealt with it, often we dealt with it because the widow or widower was already living with or close by the family. Well, I grew up in a situation where my grandparents lived upstairs, and when my grandmother died, it doesn't take away all the loneliness, but there's that sort of thing. All the celebration about kupunas and so on is one thing to say love and respect. It's another thing to see what you do actively to take care of things. So I think that the question of love and marriage going together like a horse and carriage, as much as I like, that's a Frank Sinatra song, and it was written by Sammy Kahn, who I saw do a one-man show about his life writing songs for Frank Sinatra, uh-huh. the late Sammy Kahn, the late Frank Sinatra. It goes broader and deeper because it raises questions about loneliness and about growing, even if you're older, if you have to move from doing it from a couple to an individual.
Yeah, so, when we started the segment, I was going to ask, so what, Neil, is honeymoon over? But when's your anniversary?
Let me put it this way, okay? The Frank Sinatra, Love and Marriage was a newer song than I thought it was, only because I thought it went back into the 1920s. It was first performed in 1955 by Frank Sinatra. it's not easy for me to say this, but this is only 11 years before I got married. So you do the math. I'm proud of it, but I don't want to mention the number.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it does, you know, make you stop and consider, yeah, the institutions, you know, in our lives, right? And what's important. But yeah, if it certainly helps our well-being, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's important to think about the issue of loneliness as being a continuum from very young to very old, and to see how it changes over time and how we match it. I've talked before on here about that this is a very isolated generation in the eyes of a lot of social critics, that we essentially have isolated ourselves, even starting with adolescents and teenagers, and that's something that has to be overcome.
Yeah.
So it's an issue that goes all the way through.
Well, we have to take care of our mental health, right?
Yes.
Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We've been hearing from HBR's contributing editor, Neil Milner. We'll ponder the institution of marriage as we spring into spring and prepare to head into summer, the popular times to tie the knot.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. And, you know, this week we've been revisiting recent stories about the changing local media landscape. We featured the new online media organization Aloha State Daily yesterday. Today, we hanahoa a conversation that we had with the newly launched Overstory. The name is a nod to the canopy in a forest, a fitting title in this, the year of our community forest. Kauai journalist Noel of Fuji'i Oride is helping to nurture the seedling. The online newsroom is an editorially independent program of the Kupa'a Network, whose fiscal sponsor is also the Ayo Foundation. The foundation is the nonprofit arm of Ayo Hawaii, backed by businessman Dwayne Carisu. Ayo Hawaii owns Hawaii Business Magazine, where Fuji'i Oride previously worked. She joined us recently to talk about the story behind Overstory.
So Overstory, it's an online publication that covers the systems and solutions behind Hawaii's most pressing issues. We didn't want to just cover like the problems that Hawaii is facing, though we will do some of that, but much of our journalism focuses on how communities are responding to Hawaii's challenges. And this really follows a framework that's being used around the country called solutions journalism. So this is rigorous reporting that examines the effectiveness, the lessons learned, and the limitations of various ways that people are addressing the problems they're encountering. So for us, we might be looking at local efforts that have had positive impacts on their target communities, or maybe they're actually a good fit for more wide-scale replication across multiple communities here. We might also be looking at initiatives from other jurisdictions, but there's a lot of interest in them locally. So we're not simply looking at ideas. We really want to look at initiatives that have evidence of potential, you know, evidence behind them that they'll work. And so this approach also really heavily emphasizes context and nuance. I mean, we want to understand why things are the way they are and untangle the intersections between the patterns and systems and assumptions that shape our challenges, and also inform these potential ways forward. Right now, we're covering housing, environment, and health to start with, and we're publishing an article every other Wednesday. So we don't do breaking news or daily reporting. We really want to thoughtfully add to this big and sometimes overwhelming ecosystem of information that we have, and we do hope to add more coverage areas and increase our publishing frequency as we build our own capacity.
And you're based there on Kauai, but it's not just Kauai news that we're covering here.
So we are statewide. This approach, I mean, it also really stemmed from our statewide community listening project. So when I was hired by the Kupa'a Network in May, right, it was really important for me that we do a community listening project, right? We hear from community about what they would want to see from a new local newsroom, and we just work on building meaningful relationships with the communities that we'll be covering. And so while we had identified our values and potential scope of coverage, we wanted to affirm that these aligned with Hawaii's information needs and also just information wants. So I was able to work with a team of community listening ambassadors to have one-to-one and small group conversations with folks in their communities. And again, this was statewide. And so we also had an online survey, but most of our time was spent in these one-to-one conversations that lasted anywhere from 20 minutes to, I think our longest one was 3 hours.
Wow.
And residents told us that they're really tired of seeing so many negative stories that just reiterate how expensive Hawaii is and how more locals are leaving for elsewhere. Some also told us that this negativity caused them to disengage entirely from local news just to protect their own mental health. And along these lines, we also heard requests for stories that give people hope, right, and tell them what's being done to address these issues. Also, we believe that our communities benefit when there are multiple newsrooms rigorously reporting on matters of importance to Hawaii. And so for Overstory, we didn't want to replicate what other existing journalism organizations are doing. We saw the gap for solutions journalism and also just the declining coverage on the neighbor islands. And so our reporting will embrace the mindset that there's a lot to be learned from all Hawaii's communities, and we'll especially be keeping an eye on the neighbor islands.
We have watched over the years how local newsrooms have been cut. And, you know, I know when I joined Hawaii Public Radio, you know, it was adding staff, which was nice to see.
Yeah.
And now it just seems that there are some new kids on the block, so that our listeners and, you know, readers out there will be able to hopefully find something that they feel that they can, you know, depend on.
Yes, and I think it's a really exciting time because you're also seeing these different organizations come up to fill gaps, right? They're seeing that there's a need in their communities for this different type of reporting. And so it's just really neat to see.
We've been hearing from Noel Fuji'i-Oride, who launched Overstory back in February, though it's been in the works since last spring. She is the only full-time member of its staff, though she says freelance opportunities may be available for writers and artists across the state. And let's return to our interview with Noel Fuji'i-Oride, the editor of the new online publication, Overstory. We pick up with why she believes her outlet stands out among the crowd.
You know, one other way that we're different is that we're very upfront about our values and our ethics, right? We follow the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics and some of the Institute for Nonprofit News' standards for editorial independence and financial transparency. And all of our ethics policies are on our website. And so that was important to me and to us as an organization because we do believe people deserve to know what journalistic standards we're upholding ourselves to and also just how we do our work. We do have a copy editor who is helping us to edit some of our stories. And we have also been using co-publishing partnerships. So we've co-published one of our first stories on housing cooperatives with this national newsroom called Next City. And so they've also helped us a lot by providing some editing support, too.
And you also got, what, some seed funding?
Yes, the Listening Post Collective. They provided us with a grant so that we could do our community listening project. So that enabled us to work with the community listening ambassadors and pay them so that they could have these community conversations and just spend time, right, building relationship with folks and getting to know their communities and getting to know the issues that they care about most. With this grant, I mean, we thought it was very important to share back what we learned through this community listening project. And so that's why you see on our website several stories about how this community listening project is informing our journalism. So we had one story that was kind of an introduction and an overview to this project and how it shaped like the solutions focus and how we're also going to be especially looking at the neighbor islands. We have another article about how the community listening is shaping our housing and our health coverage. We'll have another one about our environment coverage, and then we'll also be releasing a final report, I would say, in probably the next month, too, just to kind of tie everything together. And so through this grant, that's how we've also been able to work with some freelance illustrators to commission some artwork to accompany these articles.
And talk about the title. Talk about how you got the name, Overstory.
So, Overstory. I will admit, it took us quite a while to come up with a name for the journalism program. We wanted a name that had a connection to nature, and Overstory draws from the uppermost layer of Hawaii's native forest. So in this layer, it's predominantly made up of ohia and koa trees, and this vantage point, it reveals more than just a canopy, right? I mean, scientists can use it to get a very broad overview of entire watersheds and species diversity and forest health. And so our journalism really follows the same principle, right? We examine Hawaii's challenges from a systems level and revealing how different elements interconnect and influence each other. And so this perspective also helps us identify pathways towards potential solutions that honor both people and place. And it's interesting too, because our logo is an apapane, a native bird, right, that has a very symbiotic relationship with a forest overstory. And as the apapane pollinates ohia blossoms, it helps to sustain a forest's vitality. And kind of similarly, our journalism aims to cross-pollinate ideas and solutions across communities and foster meaningful civic engagement and community involvement. Another way that we're different is that as we were doing our community listening project and hearing some of the comments about what folks care about and how they want to see journalism done a little bit differently, I mean, it got us thinking about what our journalism is in service of. And so we created this statement, and it says that our journalism is in service of a more equitable and restorative Hawaii. So we envision a Hawaii where Native Hawaiians and Kama'aina can afford to stay and thrive here. Alala Hawaii and Hawaiian culture are flourishing. Hawaii's land, water, and air are healthy and have meaningful reciprocal relationships with the people who call these islands home. And Native Hawaiian stewardship practices are abundant, and all residents have equitable access to privileges and opportunities. Journalists are often told to distance themselves from the issues and people that they cover, but at Overstory, we really approach our work with the mindset that our journalists are also part of the communities we serve. And so we care about Hawaii. And this doesn't mean that we'll be advocating for one side over another in our articles. Facts and accuracy remain our priority, and we are committed to integrity, editorial independence, fairness, transparency, and democracy. But Overstory, it's really a way for us to show that we care for Hawaii, and we're trying to give people hope with accountability by connecting them to effective approaches and useful information that could just help them understand something better or meaningfully get involved in their communities. And we also hope that it helps. We hope our articles help others just grow their love and care for Hawaii and its people too.
All right. Well, Noelle, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Noelle Fujii-Oride, editor of the online publication Overstory. Check it out at overstoryhawaii.org. And that does it for us today. I'm Catherine